Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Surface Pro finally goes Kaby Lake and LTE. Water-cooled power supplies, we're not kidding. Get an SSD, speed up your PlayStation 4, and hey, go ahead, fly that unregistered drone. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 416, recorded May 25th, 2017. It's official, liquid cooling has jumped the shark.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TWITCH to save 20% on any Tracker package.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that brings you the most useful, most delightful, most affordable, the most out of reach, the most crazed mobile desktop gaming workstation. We just love hardware. And when I say we, I mean me, Patrick Norton, and the dude in Kentucky, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Are you feeling it, sir? Are you feeling the love for the hardware?
Yes. Yes. Computex comes up next week. Actually, I guess.
Are you going?
Let's see. What is today? The 20th? No. No. I was going to. I was very close to going. But I ended up deciding I didn't want to fly to Taiwan again. But there's a lot of stuff that's going to be announced and talked about and showcased it's going to keep us busy. And the 12-hour time difference is what kind of bothers me, right? So there's going to be a lot of late nights next week for me and the guys. But I think we should have more to talk about for PC enthusiasts than we have had in a while, which is good.
I feel like the release, like AMD's release of the Ryzen chipsets, we got some new and exciting GPUs coming out, and the result of that is a whole bunch of exciting stuff coming out at, I don't know, it feels like it's all fueled together, like the entire industry's gone, you know, we've been ignoring the enthusiasts for a while, but the margins are larger on the enthusiasts, and they spend more money. Maybe we should do some enthusiast projects again, or products again. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're not wrong, no, and it's, in, you know, AMD's Ryzen processor kind of is sparking changes at Intel, the Ryzen Intel or AMD announced Threadripper last week, and that's kind of a reaction to something that Intel had done several years ago when they were putting more emphasis on the HEDT platform. So it is kind of a snowball effect. All I will say, it really, since January, things haven't settled down. And I feel like almost since the GeForce, like GTX 10 series launch, the RX 480 launch, like since that, it's almost been a full calendar year of just like thing after thing after thing.
Right.
With very little lull to be found. So it's both good and bad. It's good, keeps us occupied, but it's bad in that, like, I just don't have time to like sit and process everything all at once, right, and figure out where the future trends are. But next week won't be the week to start problem. That either.
No.
Yeah.
There won't be a lot of time for reflection, but there'll be a lot of announcements. Before we get to those announcements, which won't happen until next week, which we'll talk about on the show next week, which you'll be able to find at twit.tv/Twitch. New Surface Pro, Kaby Lake, optional LTE. You know, this has been coming for a long time. Surface Pro is essentially the same design, same form factor. They feel no need to fix that at Microsoft. And having used one, I see why. But Core M3 7Y30 at the low end, Core i5 7300U for the mid-range, and the Core i7 7660U at the high end. Intel HD 615, 620, and Iris Plus 640 graphics. And they claim, with battery design tweaks, 13.5 hours of video playback, which is the only thing that Microsoft is talking about and is not entirely useful as a benchmark, because you can do lots of things to optimize for video playback that will not necessarily translate into actual real world. I'm using the interwebs and I'm doing business with my Surface Pro. But essentially same ports, same I/O options, but they're actually going to be offering 4G LTE sometime late in 2017. So,
right.
This is the first time I've done that, I think, since some Surface 3 models back in 2015. So this will probably be welcome to people that live with the LG.
Yeah, you know, it's so the Surface Pro 5 or not 5, whatever you want to call it now, isn't fundamentally changing anything, right? So it's you've got the better processor, a little bit lower power consumption. I am curious about their battery life claims, right? So they went from essentially 9 hours to 13 and a half hours on this device, but they didn't really explain how they got that. Like, do they believe Kaby Lake is the answer to this? Or did they actually increase the battery size in the device some? Like, you know, they've upgraded the platform, they could get the PCB a little bit smaller, so they were able to squeeze a little bit more battery in there. Like, I want to get some more details on that. I guess we'll find out as these start to ship and get torn down. I guess June 12th is when these hitting the stores.
I got it. They built a benchmark around H.265 4K video playback, taking advantage of Kaby Lake optimizations to deliver a perceived video playback performance boost with 4K videos in certain test scenarios. I didn't think the battery life was that bad on the Surface Pro. That's not.
No, I don't think it was either, but I think if, you know, more developers, more OEMs and vendors are starting to understand that like battery life is that key differentiating that they can do, especially when it's all these performance platforms are the same. There's really no performance story you can have that is different than your competition. I'm just curious about it from a technological standpoint at what it is. I'm disappointed that they didn't change anything on, you know, connectivity ports, you know, no Thunderbolt on this device. Whereas most of the high-end laptops from Dell, Lenovo, HP, they're featuring Thunderbolt 3, USB Type-C, none of that on here. And in fact, they're going the other way in that they are including in the box with these devices a Type-A to Type-C adapter so that if you have a USB Type-C accessory device, you can still plug it into the Surface Pro, which, you know, I had not seen one of those adapters even exist before, but clearly Microsoft recognized that this was something that people were going to want to do now that USB Type-C accessories are becoming more popular. I also find it odd that they're kind of releasing these products in a staggered fashion. Like, what was it, 2-3 weeks ago we talked about the Microsoft Surface laptop, and now we're talking about the Surface Pro. And they did the Surface, what do they call the big display? Surface Studio, thank you. You know, just before that. And they're not kind of upgrading things in tandem or in any kind of particular order. The pin isn't included this time. So there's an odd shift from them. But it still looks like good hardware. And I still was a big fan of the Surface Pro. Oh, and we don't have the Surface Book yet, right? So the question is, are they going to release a upgraded Surface Book using Kaby Lake at Computex or 2 weeks after Computex or something like that? So, an interesting kind of methodology to their releases that I don't quite understand yet.
It was very gracious of you to say methodology.
What do you think about the idea of including LTE? Is that something you would want on your laptop?
You know, if I were completely mobile all the time, or dealing with a workforce that was, you know, if I was an insurance adjuster and worked in the field constantly, LTE in my laptop would be fantastic. Currently, my LTE is in my phone, and there's no particular reason for me to have a separate LTE account for my laptop. That said, I can see lots of business applications where it would be fantastic. Or if you're constantly on the move and don't want to, you know, I don't want to find Wi-Fi cafes. I don't want to have to find Wi-Fi. I don't want to plug my phone into it, where it would be really, really useful. I'm curious. They haven't had it in a couple of years. It's either because they didn't think there was demand for it, or it was too expensive, or it was too difficult to integrate. You know, let's see what happens as the models slowly begin to ship into the marketplace.
Yep, that's fair.
FSP introduces the new Hydro PTM Plus liquid-cooled power supply. Let's say that again.
Yeah.
Water-cooled power supply known as the Hydro PTM Plus. So Jeremy wrote this up for PCPer.com. It's a 1200-watt modular power supply unit with an 80-plus platinum rating, but you can throw it, you can add it to your cooling loop, and it will provide up to 1400 watts of power for all three of you in the audience that are running three GPUs. It can be run silently up to 50% low, which is pretty fantastic, so you can hit up to 600 watts without having any noise on that one. And there are LEDs on the power supply. But, you know, if you scroll up a little bit, if you're watching the video, to that picture of the back of the PSU, not that one, keep going, right there, that is that plastic dongle there on the side of the laptop, right below your power connectors, is where you're going to add liquid cooling to the power supply. I am torn between, like, yes, something else I can liquid cool inside of a case, and, oh, my God, let's put liquid in the thing that's guaranteed to blow the circuit breaker for that part of my house.
Yeah. So I will, you know, the no water cooling is leak proof. Even if you buy a, you know, custom closed loop water cooler from your CPU, you know, from Corsair or whoever, right? Like, right. The chances of it leaking are incredibly low, but is it 100%? No. Because everything inside the power supply is a closed loop, you just, you know, you have these barbs to connect into it, and those barbs are outside of the power supply. So if there was going to be a leak, you would assume that the first failure point would be at those junctions, right? And it's probably not an accident that that little block is outside of the power supply as opposed to embedded slightly into the power supply. So you could probably ease some of your mind that way. If you have a fully cooled PC, you know, you got your GPU water blocks, your CPU water blocks, your chipset water blocks. Why not water cool your power supply, right? I don't know. I don't really have a good justification for this product, to be completely honest with you. It is a neat idea that, like, if it's not water cooled, you get this power consumption. But if you're water cooling it, you can get this power consumption. It is essentially a power supply overclock. This is maybe the wrong way to word it, but that's how I'm kind of looking at it.
Power supply over that, something.
Yeah, and it's kind of a neat idea. Is it one that I think is going to be extremely popular, and everybody's going to run out and do this, or you're going to see this duplicated in a lot of places? I don't think so. I don't know if Jeremy posted. Did he have pricing in that news post that he wrote up yet?
No.
I don't think he did.
I don't feel like this is going to be a particularly affordable.
No, like, it's already high wattage, and then you're getting this very unique niche feature to add on top of it, right? So yes, I would definitely agree with that. I think it'll be a neat thing to show off in demo systems, which is what you know, the FSP group will be doing. And if, you know, if you're a modder, if you're a system builder that is building these demo machines, these machines that are built to basically sit on a pedestal and be impressive looking, water cooling your power supply with LEDs is worth adding to the list, I guess, the checkbox of crazy things PC enthusiasts have done.
I don't even know if that qualifies as crazy, except for the liquid cooling part. LEDs, it's a lifestyle choice, man. I don't know. I love my current, you know, AM4 motherboard, but I'm still kind of fascinated by the fact that they embedded LEDs in the PCB. 'Cause, you know, style, fashion. And it's all sealed inside my case where no one can see the color, and that's what makes me happiest. The I don't know. While we're talking about power supplies, Seasonic's got a new high-wattage power supply. Lee Garbutt wrote it up for PC per the Seasonic Prime 1200-watt gold power supply. At what point do we have too many power supplies?
it was a long time ago, to be fair. I mean, even if you look at that table right there, that is the Seasonic Prime power supply. So they have some 80-plus titanium, 80-plus platinum, and 80-plus gold. You're looking at 14 different units there, all ranging from 650 watts up to 1,200 watts. There are a lot of power supplies out there, but there are a lot of computers out there, and every computer has to have a power supply. You do get into a lot of choice overload with these types of things, though. I will freely admit that, and I am in that mindset as well. But
I mean, we should I know we talked about it a couple weeks ago or a month ago, but it's in order of increasing efficiency. It's 80 plus, 80 plus bronze, 80 plus silver, 80 plus gold, 80 plus platinum, finally 80 plus titanium, which is 94% efficient at a 50% load. If you're looking at 115 volt U.S. current, 80 plus, of course, is 80% efficient at 20, 50, or 100% loads. Bronze goes up to 82, 85, and then 82%. And you notice there's the peak efficiency of most of these power supply ratings is at 50% load. So if you want to absolutely wring the most efficiency out of your power supply, you should buy too much power supply and then run it at 50% load, which is, I think, the real reason we see all these 1,200-watt power supplies is so you can run them at 600 watts and achieve, you know, three extra percentage points of efficiency. Not that I'm starting to find all of these individual subtle ratings on power supplies to be, you know, a bit too much, right? Because it's like 80-plus gold is 90% efficient at a 50% load, 80 plus platinum is 92% efficient at a 50% load, and 80 plus titanium is 94% efficient at a 50% load, but only 90% efficient at a 10% load. So at some point, if you're not overloading, sorry, I just wanted to rant about that for a moment because it's a bit much.
It is, but I will say like 80 plus bronze and silver are much more rare nowadays, pretty much. I don't want to say everything, but most power supplies that I see being launched are starting at gold and moving up, right? Just the technology has improved. Right. The components have improved in such a way that gold is kind of the new minimum-ish.
Bronze.
Although, and then depending on what you're going to spend, right, you can still get down into those lower priced units that will still be in the bronze and silver range. This power supply is unique. It's Seasonic's Prime design, which is a total revamp for them that started last year, going from an analog system to a digital power management system. they were kind of the last to do it, but that was mostly because they were regarded to have the absolute best in analog power delivery system and power management systems in their unit. So they didn't feel like they needed to get rid of that advantage until basically they were the last ones left with the analog and it started to be seen as a negative. That being said, Lee has been nothing but impressed with the new platform since they started selling it. And it also comes with a 12-year warranty, which is kind of nuts, right? That's when you get into warranties that are so long that I feel like you would that they're almost the warranty is so long it's almost useless, because at what point do you just forget that power supply existed? I guess it's better than the alternative of having a 1 year.
There was
at this point, why not just offer a lifetime warranty?
A 10-year warranty is probably a lifetime, you know, a lifetime and a half, you know, for a PC owner,
for most computers, right?
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you, I am okay with them overbuilding power supplies. If it's $20 for a 10-year, you know, if I'm spending $10 or $20 and they're giving me a 10-year guarantee, you know, I don't know if I'm actually, they're going to be around in 10 years or if I also have the receipt to make the claim in 10 years. But that basically means they believe, you know, it should mean that they believe they built it so well, they will effectively never have to replace it. I mean, I had a cousin who drove a Chrysler hatchback in the late 80s, early 90s that was on, you know, they had these guarantees, but he was on like his fourth transmission at that point. It's nice that Chrysler kept replacing his transmissions, but it would have been much nicer if they built one that lasted the entire time. For the most part, with the reputable brands, they are overbuilding the snot out of these power supplies and in a way that they should not fall apart with any reasonable amount of use.
Agreed. Just thinking. That's a reasonable jump to make from like, hey, if you're confident in your power supply to offer that type of warranty, then I'm confident that you're not doing a crappy job of building power supplies just in general. So this product did get editor's choice from Lee. So pretty much strengths all across the board there. High efficiency, a selectable fanless control mode, very quiet, high quality fans. The 12-year warranty was on there. The only weakness he had was they went with the system where there's two of the 8-pin PCIe connectors off of or that are daisy chained off of a single cable out of the back of a power supply. There's no functional issue with that. It's more of a usability and aesthetic difference. So if you have a video card that only has one you know, PCIe connection, whether it be a 6 or an 8, then you're going to have this other plastic connector that's daisy chained off of it, you know, just kind of sitting there that you either have to quietly tuck away, move away, or whatever. So that's seems like a seemingly minor quibble, but that's why it still got the Editor's Choice Award that it did. So a pretty good All power right. supply. That one's $199. Although if you go down to the 650 watt model, excuse me, of the same series, those retail down for $114. So much more in line with people's expectations.
And if you do not expect to be adding a second GPU to your desktop, probably a much more reasonable choice. Although you'll lose 2 or 3% because you're not operating 1,200 watts at 50% load.
right.
Oh, my goodness. You know, props to Lenovo, not to change the subject, but Lenovo returned to profit. That was the announcement Thursday. Warned everybody that rising component prices and shortages on batteries could create problems. But, 535 million on this year to March, you know, down like 4% in overall sales. But basically, I'm bringing this up because, you know, one of our favorite badass laptop manufacturers is making money despite the fact that the PC market continues to shrink, which is which I'm happy about. But the other thing that's interesting is when you look at the analyst reports on these, occasionally you find things that are interesting, like, oh, wow, might be short, you know, batteries might be in short supply, memory shortages, which I am told are due to the amount of Android devices receiving staggering amounts of memory that Android probably can't actually use to feed the massive Chinese phone market, is putting pressure on memory supplies for solid state drives and desktops. And apparently cars, according to this Reuters article, is the reason why there are starting to be shortages in supplies on laptop batteries. But
interesting.
You know, yeah, Lenovo's mobile business is a little bit behind.
I guess that makes sense.
You know, but yeah, it's interesting. Like they're down a little bit on mobile. Well, their mobile devices are down $566 million, although it's growing in certain parts of the world. It's interesting to look at. I don't know. In theory, though, Lenovo is making money, which is good because we need big, massive PC manufacturers making stuff.
And I think part of the takeaway from that is that it is still a growing field, right? Like, it's if Lenovo is still able to grow, then that's a good sign for not necessarily the enthusiast market. You know, Lenovo is not really a big player in that specific field, but desktop PCs to some degree and notebooks more specifically. So
there you have it. On a completely random note that I thought was interesting, the most popular, I should say the phone with the highest customer satisfaction, on the American Consumer Satisfaction Index is the iPhone SE, the 4-inch smartphone from Apple. Customer satisfaction score of 87 out of 100, finishing just ahead of Samsung's 5.7-inch Galaxy S6 Edge Plus and the 5.5-inch iPhone 7 Plus. MacRumors picked up the article on that. I thought that was interesting. Basically, like the top 20 phones are pretty much all iPhone and Galaxy models. Apparently,
that's
iPhone.
That's pretty. Apple. Pretty damning for the rest of the market.
Well, yeah. Or you could just say that those might also be the most commonly sold or the largest selling smartphones out there, and therefore they dominate the surveys. But iPhone SE, 87 points. Galaxy S6 Edge Plus, 86 points. iPhone 7 Plus, Galaxy S6 Edge, S7, S7 Edge. iPhone 6 Plus, iPhone 6S Plus, iPhone 7, Galaxy Note 5, Galaxy Note 4, Galaxy S5, and you just keep going down. I thought it was interesting. It's interesting to know also that my wife is not the only person that wants a more modern camera and processor inside of the original or the smaller iPhone packaging. So
right.
I was curious. Yeah, it's... You know, mostly a lot of older phones, but that's also because most people are still using older phones because they haven't bought the brand new flagship models. But yeah, I'm with you. You know, you're talking about like a 7-point spread, and I don't think you've even gotten to anything that's not Apple or Samsung in the top of
the
chart.
Yeah, that's a dramatic difference. Yes.
That also might have to do with just the sheer, you know, the fact that Apple and Samsung have such a huge percentage of the volume of the top of the line phones. But I take that back. LG G4 and the Moto G are down there. And let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Whoops. Somewhere around 20 something, 25th or so. Yeah, well, props to LG and Motorola for getting on the board, so to speak. But you think about the LG G5 was the crazy modular model that I think sounded better on paper.
Yes.
You know.
Than actually turned out to be.
Turned out to be in real life. And, yeah. You know, Motorola's had a couple of exciting years, but... something to think about while you're phone shopping. If you're the kind of person that loses stuff, and some of us are, we'd like to remind you this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker. Life is supposed to be a journey of discovery, but how much of it do you waste trying to discover where you left your keys or your backpack, you know, or anything? You don't have to ever worry about losing things again thanks to Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone. It's simple. You just place a Tracker device in whatever you tend to lose, your keys, your wallets, your bags, your pets. Man, I hate it when my dog runs off. Use the Tracker app to find it in just seconds. Track up to 10. Like you've never had your dog disappear and thought to yourself, gosh, if I just had something on it to track it. I've seen pictures.
You are 100% correct.
Don't be all like, oh, yeah, they come every time I call. My dog doesn't come every time I call, and certainly my backpack doesn't come every time I call. And you know what? If my backpack is wandering away because somebody other than me picked it up, the Tracker can help me out with that too. You can track and ring the same device from multiple phones and Tracker accounts. You can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind or before your item leaves you behind. And if you lose your phone, just press the button on your Tracker device or ask your Amazon Echo, and your phone will ring even if it's on silent so you can find it. You just hope you didn't, you know, leave it under the cat. And if you need more help, the Tracker Pixel comes with a powerful LED light so you can find your items in a flash. It's available in fun seasonal colors. Who doesn't like a little splash of color? With over 4.5 million devices shipped, Tracker has the largest crowd locate network in the world so you can find your item even if it's miles away. Do yourself a favor. Try Tracker today with their 30-day money-back guarantee. Find what you've been missing. Go to thetracker.com and use the promo code TWICH to save 20% on any Tracker package. And, you know, if you think about it, if there's a, you know, person in your life, perhaps a spouse, perhaps a child that constantly loses things and they have a smartphone, a Tracker might be a lovely, lovely gift for the end of the school year. Just laying that out there after having heard a friend of mine on the phone go off on an amazing 20-minute tirade about lost keys in his home. Yeah, just saying. Anyhow, we want to thank Tracker for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And one last time, thetracker.com, and use the promo code TWITCH to save 20% on any Tracker package. Oh, my goodness. More from the Kronos group talking about the OpenCL and Vulkan roadmap, which are merging, becoming as one. We talked about this a little bit last week. Are you excited about this?
Yeah.
Or
it's hard to be overly excited just because it's so new. Like it's just now at the beginning stages. They basically decided, they said in this interview that Scott posted, that they just decided to do it like 2 weeks ago, right? So it is, I mean, it's exciting in that it should simplify things to the point where you basically want it to be not just DirectX. You want to have DirectX, you want to have a competitor. And we always had OpenGL, and then we had Vulkan, and we had OpenCL. They were three different kind of disparate things. And OpenCL was was more thought of as a professional application API as opposed to something that would be used for gaming and 3D workloads. Now merging it in makes it more like the Microsoft side, where you kind of have Direct Compute, DirectX, kind of merged into one umbrella, if you will. And Kronos decided they were going to do the same thing on that end. So OpenCL, over some period of time, will now be merged back into, or not back, merged into the Vulkan umbrella, and it will just be Vulkan kind of moving forward, which is really what you, not just what we should want, but what you need in order to make a competitive alternative. Because if you look, I mean, Microsoft is this enormous giant. It's one company. They get to make all the decisions. Kronos is an open standard group that requires input from a bunch of different people. So anytime that is the case, things take longer to happen the majority of the time. So streamlining anything and simplifying things from both standardization point of view as well as development and integration point of view is going to be beneficial in the long term. And I don't want to – the interview itself is fairly dense in content, meaning that if you like to geek out on the idea of APIs and what this means for your GPU hardware and compute hardware and compute capabilities going forward, it's pretty interesting. But there's a lot there. If you're just starting out, it may be a difficult place to start, I guess. But still has a lot of information in there. And they were very kind of open and honest about it. It's not very often you get a company or organization that's willing to say like, yeah, no, we just kind of decided this 2 weeks ago. But we felt like we needed to clarify some comments. So here we are talking with you about these very things. So, it looks like the OpenCL side of it is actually the one is being responsible for merging into Vulkan and like so that the Vulkan team's roadmap doesn't change. They're not slowing down the improvements to Vulkan. It's kind of up to the OpenCL group to figure out what the strategy is going to be to integrate in and on what timeline. So I'll be curious to see what that turns into. But, you know, Scott did a good job following up on this and talking with, you know, getting some tweet comments from guys like Tim Sweeney and Otoy, which is one of the big GPGPU kind of compute cloud-based systems out there in the world, about their thoughts of single source C++ graphics APIs. So nice. A deep and very technical discussion, but one that I think will mean a lot more in, say, 2 years, 18 months, something like that, when they actually kind of complete this merger and can start to give software developers the tools, the simplified tools to utilize both APIs at one time.
Oh, my goodness. The interesting article up on PC Per this week, PS4 Pro SSD upgrade, does SATA 3 make a difference? Jim Tanis wrote that up. You know, it's kind of impressive. At the very least, the SATA 3 interface on the PlayStation 4 Pro does make a difference if your games are bottlenecked by storage performance. The non-Pro PS4 going to a Samsung 850 resulted in a 9.8% improvement in loading times over the stock hard disk drive, anywhere from 0% to as much as 22% faster. The PS4 Pro, which can do full SATA 3 speeds, saw an overall average improvement of 27.5%, ranging from 7% to a whopping 66%. That's huge. Now, you're also talking about they used a 1 terabyte, they used a 1 terabyte Samsung 850 Evo, which is a $350 SSD, which is a significant percentage of the cost of the console. Literally, like, you know,
yes,
basically the same amount as you would spend on the console. You know, if you have 3 games, you don't need to buy 1 terabyte drive. If you have a ton of games, you might want to go whole hog on the 350 just to spend less time loading stuff. You know, mm-hmm. The other thing to think about is this is also before 4K really gets serious on the PS4 Pro. Because there just really aren't much in the way of high-resolution 4K games on the PlayStation 4. But 4K games, you know, are going to be using larger textures, bigger assets, which is going to make the bottlenecking on the original hard drive more noticeable. So something to think about and an interesting read if you want to kind of get into the nitty-gritty on upgrading your PlayStation 4 Pro or your PlayStation. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Like, the standard hard disk drive versus an SSD... on a PlayStation versus an SSD in a PlayStation Pro 4, taking load times from nearly 50 seconds down to 26 seconds. A 50% improvement in load times, to me, is nothing to sneeze about. But then if you look at some of the other games, it might be 2 seconds on a 14-second load time. So,
I will say, one of the interesting topics that came up in our discussion of this story yesterday was that in some of the games, the developers had hidden load times behind specific sequences, right? Longer form animations, like in Grand Theft Auto V, when you do character switches, there's a zoom out from that character, a pan across the map, and then it zooms into a character, and it's like a 15-second process. And if you look at the testing that Jim did in that particular instance, like there's it shows no advantage from the hard drive to the SSD, which is unlikely to be true, right? But instead, what our working theory is that in that particular instance, that the developer realized that there was a load time, and they just built this animation around it, and it's not a variable speed animation, so they just kind of, it's 14 seconds or 13 seconds kind of no matter what. Again, we don't know this for sure. This is just kind of what we're guessing, but it makes sense. And if you look at some of the other games, you'll see the same type of stuff where, you know, transitioning between maps and stuff, like they go, well, okay, in general, console hardware is static, so you know how long it would take to load between these two sections. So, okay, how do we make this less painful, or the appearance or effectiveness of being less painful to the consumer? We just make something pretty happen on the screen. And in those instances, it's possible that like upgrading to an SSD won't matter. But if you look at the other part of GTA where you're just loading up the map, when you see that huge drop in performance, yeah, you go from 73 seconds to 25 seconds to load up the single player save game, right? Going from a hard drive to an SSD on the same PS4 Pro hardware. That's a dramatic jump. So yeah. My kind of takeaway from this was, the sooner we can get SSDs to the point where they're cheap enough to be included in game consoles, that developers will be able to better take advantage of the total system performance, because they won't have to worry about some of those types of things. It's one of those like chicken egg debates about, does the software developer write in preparation for newer hardware, or does the newer hardware have to exist before the game developers are willing to, you know, spend the time to write to it and address it? And this seems to be one of those instances where maybe we're seeing both.
Did you just ask which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I usually on a regular cadence, I do that, actually. Yeah. I don't have the necessary verbal vocabulary to extend much beyond that.
No, but it's pretty accurate either way. Interesting note this week. If you, like me, have simply refused to fly any of your drones above a certain weight because you didn't want to register them and therefore create a searchable database of your drone ownership, you should be happy because there is no registry for non-commercial drones anymore. If you're making money with your drones, you still have to register them with the FAA, but Americans no longer have to register non-commercial drones with the FAA. And April Glazer, who's a fantastic science and technology writer over at Recode.net, points out that, quote, surprisingly, the drone industry isn't thrilled, end quote. Federal court in Washington, D.C. has decided that you no longer have to register your drone with the FAA. Now, those are the rules which have been in place since 2015. Apparently are considered to be in violation of a law passed by Congress in 2012. Ms. Glazer writes, quote, that law, the FAA Modernization and Reform Act, prohibited the FAA from passing any rules on the operation of model aircraft. In other words, rules that restrict how non-commercial hobbyist drone operators fly, end quote. So, was part of a lawsuit brought by John Taylor, who brought the case against the FAA in January 2016. And this is more than 820,000 people have registered to fly drones. Now, DJI's head of policy, Brendan Schulman, sent an email to Recode that says, quote, the FAA's innovative approach to drone registration was very reasonable, and registration provides for accountability and education to drone pilots. I expect the legal issue that impedes this program will be addressed by cooperative work between the industry and policymakers. So, We shall see what happens over time, but for now, you do not have to register your drones. Meanwhile,
I'm a fan of this.
Article
yes.
points out. Yeah, I'm a fan of this too. You know, but the other thing is that the FAA is looking to figure out a way for unmanned aircraft to be remotely identified. But again, this is kind of like micro stamping on handguns. You know, if it's something where you can spend 15 seconds with a nail file and make it go away, it's questionable as to whether or not it's actually going to be effective in preventing, I'm not going to say as much as crimes, as stupid behavior. If you have a drone, do us a favor, obey the rules for flying it. Stay away from airports. Don't buzz crowds. If you've just bought a new DJI drone or any other brand of drone, don't take it over a giant packed baseball stadium for your first flight. I bring that up because you see some of the things people do. I just got my new drone and I'm going to ride it over the football game here. And all of a sudden, although the person I'm thinking of had a kind of a Boston accent and was in San Francisco, and nearly wipes out, you know, an entire row at a stadium. If you have a drone, learn how to fly it really, really well before you put it near people. You know, do us a favor. Because I've seen some brand new multi-$1,000 out-of-the-box drones do things like auger in on a spiral pattern because maybe their flight control systems didn't work the way they were supposed to. Bad to find that out overneath, you know, if your drone's above grandma at a family reunion or if you're, say, above a bunch of lawyers at a baseball game. Try not to be sued by 22 people because you did something stupid.
When I was on vacation last week, we were at the beach, I saw somebody fly a drone over the water, like right above the beach line or whatever. And I had that thought in my head. It's like, what if they're breaking the law doing this or not? You know, either because they're in a public place. Does that matter? It was an interesting thing. Me personally, I don't really care. I stream the show with you, and we say public stupid things all the time. But I imagine there were a lot of people on that beach that were watching it hover over, and were starting to question or get angry or stuff like that. So it's an interesting social dilemma.
Well, you know, if people don't do stupid things over and over again, there tends to be less of a need for laws banning or not so much banning stupid behavior as making stupid behavior something you can go to prison for. You know, the FAA has its no drone zone, you know, the free digital toolkit where basically it's like, you know, for example, the National Capital Region has a special flight rules area within a 30-mile radius of Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. That restricts all flights in the greater D.C. area. There's a 15-mile inner ring, a 30-mile outer ring. Flying an unmanned aircraft within the 15-mile inner radius or radius inner ring is prohibited. You have to go to the FAA and get permission before you fly a drone in D.C., basically. You know, flying a UAS if you're doing recreational or non-recreational use between 15 and 30 miles from Washington, D.C. So the 15-mile inner radius, no fly zone. 15 to 30 miles, you can do it if the aircraft weighs less than 55 pounds, including everything attached to it. If the aircraft is registered and marked, okay, that part doesn't seem to be the law anymore. If you fly below 400 feet, if you fly within visual line of sight, if you fly in clear weather conditions, if you don't fly in your other aircraft. This is also the most restricted airspace in the continental or period in the United States. If you want to be stupid with a drone, do yourself a favor. Don't do it inside of DC. There's a really great safety checklist that the FAA put together. That reminds you that, you know, you are a pilot, you are in charge of an airframe. Now, if you're a drone enthusiast, you may look at these things like I always fly within visual line of sight and be like, no. And that's you're snickering, but I know people who for them the challenge is to actually, you know, how far can they fly? How far away can they get? How well can they navigate? You know, but, you know, the basic rules, fly below 400 feet, fly within visual line of sight. Be aware of FAA airspace requirements, i.e. keep your drone out of an airport or the zone around an airport. Don't fly over groups of people. Don't fly over stadiums and sports events. Don't fly within 5 miles of an airport without first contacting air traffic control and airport authorities. Don't fly in your emergency response efforts, such as fires. Don't fly in your other aircraft. Don't fly under the influence. You know, these are all really smart things. And, you know, if you talk to a first responder that's been buzzed by a drone, they're going to be really irritated because, you know, hey, if they're fighting a fire or if they're trying to keep somebody alive and some jackass is like, I'm going to get the best footage ever from our YouTube channel, they're going to be pissed. You know, especially if they're a firefighter, they have fire hoses, they spray water, they will take your drone out, and they will laugh hysterically when you come to pick up the pieces. I think based on firefighters, I know I can certainly see that happening. You know, there's also things where, you know, drones are amazing tools. They could be amazing tools for search and rescue. They could aid, in all sorts of amazing ways, but it's a fairly new technology and be smart, especially if you've just bought a drone. If your first drone is a $1,200 drone, put it back in the box, and go look at some of Father Robert's stuff or some of the stuff we talked about on Tech Thing. Buy yourself a $40 drone and learn how to fly it incredibly well. And then get your, 2-pound, 35-mile-an-hour missile and go use it. But don't learn how to fly on something that can do 25, 35 miles an hour. And don't fly over people. You know, if you're unbelievably talented and you're good with flying over people, just don't crash into them. Sounds stupid, but then again, not driving drunk, something people still have a problem with. All right, enough about drones. Okay, one last thing about drones. DJI's got a new drone, a little relatively tiny one. It's like $499, the Spark drone.
Yeah.
Even
though this one's small, it says reach speeds of 31 miles an hour, has a 3D sensing camera, GPS, and onboard vision positioning system to help keep the system stable, even indoors when the signal is crappy.
Not a racing drone, primarily like a photo and video taking device. It's pretty cool. It's a pretty badass drone. Their Mavic folding drone is also, I got to say, one of the coolest things I've ever seen. The Mavic Pro with the folding props. A friend of mine pretty much gave up building his own drones when that came out. So I
continue to be surprised at my lack of... this seems like something that it would be right up my alley that I would own like 6 of them. But I so far own 0 of like modern ones, which is better for my wallet. But, it probably won't last in the long term.
Take your time, because first you buy one, then you've got like 3, and then there's a couple for the kids, although your kids are a little young yet. Ease into it. And also, last year's drones available for very affordable prices on Craigslist, to think about. But if you want to dip your toe into the water, I'm a big fan of the inexpensive Hubsan drones. For like $40, you can get a fantastic drone that's easy to fly. I'm a little nervous about the fact that DJI is apparently doing a cell phone-based control system for that new drone. That makes me a little nervous because most cell phone, the Parrot drones are one of the worst experiences I've ever had with a product. When you make a 7-year-old cry because they can't actually make the drone fly anywhere without crashing into things, this is not the introductory experience you want.
But correct.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
I'd agree with that.
Hubsan's X4s as starter drones. So they're cheap. There's lots of spare parts for them. Oh yeah, buy the drone. Buy a thing to protect the rotors on the drone or the propellers on the drone, and then buy like 25 extra propellers. Buy a crash kit for your drones. You will need it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I would absolutely do that. And I would absolutely need them for that too. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So, as we mentioned, Computex next week, there'll be a flood of news. We're probably going to talk about like 25 things with about a minute for each thing next week.
Yes. Seems likely.
It looks like the Radeon Vegas are coming out in July. We've got the new high-end Radeon parts coming. Who knows what excitement's going to come from Intel next week. But, keep your eyes and ears open and keep tuned to PCPer.com. And of course, you can find me over at techthing.com and AVXL.com. Robert Herron and I did an AVXL this week where we basically eviscerated television operating systems and talked about what you should buy instead of relying on a television operating system. That's AVXL.com for that one. Man.
Very cool.
I'm excited. I'm excited for Computex this year. I'm not excited.
I think there's a lot of stuff. I think the only person that the only major company that I don't know if they're going to show anything like new Wowie for consumer side is NVIDIA. I don't think they will show consumer Volta, any of that type of stuff yet. I think it's too early for anything like that. But everybody else, like, you know, Asus and Intel and AMD, both CPU and GPU, I think they're going to have some pretty interesting stuff to show. Maybe not on sale next week, but interesting things to show at the very least.
Nothing wrong with interesting things to show. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we mentioned earlier, twit.tv/Twitch is where you can find all the older episodes of This Week in Computer Hardware. And we invite you to go over there, listen to the old shows, learn how to subscribe. Tell your friends if you enjoy the show. We'd appreciate that. And you can always ask us questions at Patrick Norton on the Twitter or at Ryan Schrout on the Twitter, because we are so creative with our Twitter names to help you find us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week, folks.